You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Susan Simpkins. Susan, it's good to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here.
So, Susan, the way the show begins is with a huge question, an impossible question, but it allows us to start the conversation. Who are you? What do we need to know about the big picture pieces of the life you aspire to live, what you value, what you've done? What do we need to know to start the conversation?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a child of God. I'm an island girl. I grew up in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and I was a single parent from the time I was pregnant until self-sufficiency, my daughter, until she could support herself. And I've been a professor and a researcher for 25 years now at Penn State University. I'm a wife. I just got married for the first time 2 years ago. And then I just published a memoir this past summer, so I'm an author. And so those are sort of the roles that I've played across the years of my life, kind of in the order in which they happened.
So what are some of the values or the qualities that have kind of guided your life through all of those transitions and labels?
I really love a good story, and I love underdog stories, and I love stories with good endings. And I feel like I've lived one of those stories. And so my story is really one of extremes. For example, neither of my parents graduated from high school. My dad maybe made it to the eighth grade, and here I am. I train PhD students for a living. When I got pregnant with my daughter, it was an unplanned pregnancy, and it was a result of exploitation. I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. And my daughter now, I look at her as the crown jewel of my life. So I was a single parent on welfare, and I couldn't envision a day where my daughter and I are now partnering together in a ministry to help people understand that pain doesn't have to have the last word in their lives.
Right.
I suffered with panic attacks with writing. And so to be in a profession where I write for a living, and also to have, you know, now I've published a book, not having had to, but doing it because I felt led to in a lot of ways. I mean, that's just amazing to me when I look at that. And then I said I was never going to get married, you know, because of the pain of what I had experienced and my heart being broken and betrayed and abandoned. I was never going to trust anyone like that ever, or get anywhere close to trusting anyone. And then now I'm happily married. So my life is just filled with amazing contrast. And so I really am valuing the fact that I think a story is one of the most beautiful things that you can give people, because it's really the window to who you are, where you came from, and who you are now. And that, again, is a contrast, because I spent most of my life being ashamed of my story and hiding from it, from myself. And, you know, I was never going to be open and tell anybody about my story ever, really. And so that's another, again, trust.
Right. And good stories are built on really incredible tensions and conflicts, and some of which are overwhelming or irreconcilable, but they drive the storyline forward, and they can be the sources of shame or the sources of guilt or the sources of all sorts of things we don't want to share. They are muscular, they are alive, they're just like the body that's held together by ligaments that have opposing muscles that keep us moving as long as we're alive.
And
that's very
certainly powerful. And I think that in telling my story, what I'm recognizing as one of the values that's really important, I think, is vulnerability. And as I've shared it, and again, opened myself up to be able to share parts of my story at different times with people, others have felt comfortable to start to share their stories with me. So it is a bit of a reciprocal effect that when you are the first one to be vulnerable, other people many times are vulnerable back.
What you are giving a window into is what it's like to be in a community of persons who are not isolated individuals, but they have their, each has their own story.
Right.
And we become stronger because our wisdom is greater when we know each other's stories.
Absolutely.
And when we can, and I work with a lot of older people, and sometimes I know their stories and can tell them back to them when they have lost their memories. And it creates another kind of link in life.
Right.
Very powerful. Susan, what would you like to? Go ahead.
Sorry. I just think with friendships, that's an important part to tell, remind people of their story when they've forgotten, you know, some of the good things that have happened, or things aren't always terrible, or look at this good thing that happened in your life. I find that that's a valuable aspect for me to receive and for me to give to other friends.
Right. Cool. So what would you like to begin the show with musically?
I'd like to start with I Dreamed a Dream. It's from the musical Les Miserables, which is my favorite musical. And it's a painful story. When I first heard it, it just moved me so greatly because it talks about your dreams being shattered. And I think everybody can relate to it in some manner, that pain is part of the human experience. And it's certainly been part of my story and my mosaic in my life.
Here we go.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by, when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I prayed that God would be forgiving. Then I was young and unafraid, when dreams were made and used and wasted. There was no ransom to be paid, no song unsung, no wine untasted. But the time has come at night, with a voice as soft as thunder, as they tear your hopes apart, and they turn your dream to shame.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Susan Simpkins. So Susan, you have already listed some of the incidents that you had to live through to become the person you are. And I guess the accent point I want to put on this now is, What did you have to learn from those experiences to know how to live the life that you value now?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah.
I think that a big part of it was having the hope that things could get better. I think, you know, it's a temptation when you're in a lot of pain emotionally because of things that have happened to think that it's always going to be that way. And to be able to hope that it's not just going to be a little better, but it actually could be totally different, you know, 180 degree turn. So I think one of the pivotal experiences was I've, you know, again, come from a background of a lot of pain, a lot of abuse in my childhood, very dysfunctional home. My dad is an alcoholic and he was mentally ill as well. And he was also a criminal. So he spent time in prison. So you get the whole shebang, and he's violent and he's abusive. And just so much pain, you know, wrapped up in all of that. And so when I was in graduate school and I joined this class that my church was putting on to be, you know, emotional pain management class kind of thing. And it's the first time that I ever began to process pain that I'd experienced in my past. And it was very, I didn't know what to expect, and I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be to begin to heal from that. But I remember the pastor said something one time in the midst of a class that was very difficult. I mean, you have people experiencing rape and incest, you know, just the all the gnarly issues that are so devastating to people. And I had my own pain as well. And he said, you know, maybe you're never going to get to the point where, and I don't even remember after that, but something rose up inside of me that couldn't accept that. And I continue to look back at this as a pivotal point in my life, because I thought it was really, it was unlike me to be able to do this. Here I was, my whole life was a total mess. I'm a single parent, I'm on welfare. You know, I'm trying to get through graduate school as a single parent. And there was no area of my life where I had any margin, you know, financially or socially or time, any area. So, but something erupted inside of me. And I said, you know, I can't accept what you said. You know, I'm going to be free. I have to be free. These things that happened to me, most of them weren't even my fault. And now you're telling me that I'm never going to arrive at some point. And I started to think about how free can you get, you know, and I started to investigate this in the Bible and with my faith of just like, God, how big are you? You know, can I really get free? Can I really be at a place where it's completely different than where I am now? Because if that is the goal and that is the place where I can get to, then it's worth the pain of going through this process of healing, because it hurts. But if it's just a little less depressed, or you're going to be in therapy for the rest of your life, I mean, nothing against therapy. I've benefited from it and I'm thankful for it, recommend it even. But you know, it's like, can you be free? And can that heart that's broken be mended and healed? And so that's what I believe. I believe that what God offers is something supernatural, that he can actually heal that broken heart and get you to a place where you never thought you could be.
Right. So help me understand the transition. What were you doing with your pain before that you had to learn to do differently after you realized that you could be liberated and made free and made whole?
Right. I was stuffing it down. I was pretending it didn't exist. I was putting one foot in front of the other and moving on. And I'd learned that well from my mom, you know. So she had her own pain in my childhood. You know, again, her husband was an alcoholic, mentally ill. We don't know what to do. We have all these intractable problems. And she kept everything together, you know, for our family. And part of it was just kind of ignore things, you know, and you keep moving on and you just put food on the table, you do the next thing. And that has a function to it. I mean, I have daughter to take care of. There are the practicalities of life that you do need to attend to. And so on the outside,
surviving is a success some days.
Exactly. Absolutely. but long term, it's never going to get you where you really need to be. You're not alive. You're not alive on the inside. You're dead. And I was part of the walking dead.
Mm-hmm. So what brought you back? What did you do? How did you experience life coming back into you? What were you doing that helped that to happen?
Again, I think that decision to believe that I could be free was the impetus of doing things like dealing with the pain, facing it, you know, having not ignoring it anymore, but looking it in its face and letting the emotions come that I didn't experience before. The rage, you know, the anger, the grief, the sorrow of what I lost my childhood and what had been taken from me, what I'd been robbed of, just being truthful. And I think part of what I didn't do before was tell the truth about what really happened.
Right.
I sanitized it, I whitewashed it, I kind of pretended it wasn't there most of the time, and you just move on. So dealing with the reality of it and facing that, allowing that to the emotions to come, and then inviting God to come in to those places where it just was excruciatingly hard and devastating, inviting him to come in and say, please, please help me, please heal me. I don't even know where it hurts. It just hurts all over. How do you heal a broken heart? You don't even know where it is. You know, the central innermost part of you, right? It's broken. It affects everything else.
Not only it's broken, it's crushed. I think that's more of the image that you're sharing. It's not just
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is there something you would like to share of your poetry or of your music at this particular moment?
Sure. I can share one poem. It's called The Lobster God. And it really, I think, encapsulates a lot of my story of starting in a place of devastation and getting to a place of healing and wholeness. Okay. Everyone got to my heart before you did. I gave them what they desired, and they helped themselves to the resources of innocence and naivete, promising large returns on my investment, but leaving me depleted and bankrupt. All that remained was the empty echo of what once was, shattered dreams, broken pieces, charred remains, and the inescapable poverty in my soul. To survive, I learned how to ration, carefully calculating every expenditure, cautiously doling out the absolute necessary. Absolutely necessary, stretching every meager deposit, resourcefully planning for the leanness in my horizon. But in my horizon, there was you. Starving, deprived, and wretched as I was, I would have been satisfied with a hamburger on a paper plate, but you wined and dined me with gourmet delicacies, serving me lobster on the finest china and lace tablecloth, pouring out the vintage wine in a silver goblet. Just your compassion on my hapless state would have been undeserved, but you went well beyond pity and sincere affection and lavished me with your exquisite love and passion. With unrestrained and unreserved abandon, you touched my leprous sores, washed the filth from my feet, caressed my cheek with those nail-scarred hands, asked me if I would be yours forever, and I wept in awe at the sheer extravagance of it all. I wanted to offer you something whole, intact, virgin, but you were the last, not the first. And I tried to beautify the ashes of my heart, gluing the scattered fragments back together, fretting over the utter futility of my most diligent efforts. You accepted all that was left, all that I had, but I agonized over the best, receiving the least, and pleaded for something unbroken to love you with. You melted down the hard, callous places, transformed the walled fortresses into open fields, bloomed roses in the rubbled ash heap, fanned flickering, frigid embers, excavated the passion beneath the frozen exterior. And I wrapped up my brand new heart and gave it back to you with a bow on top.
That is stunning. So that's the fruit of years, if not decades, of work.
Decades. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I want to, as you tell that, not you tell the that the idea of hope that you could possibly be free of this shame, worthlessness, brokenness, guilt. You could be free of it, but it was no guarantee. And you set out on the journey to see where you could go. And this is part of where you've come. What I want to talk through, because I think some of the listeners, and we don't often hear about this, is people who are surviving and stuffing a lot of stuff down often are kind of stoic and unavailable, and they have too much of a sense, though understandably, because they're survivors, that they control the outcome of their life. And it's more complicated than that, but it's hard to accept that. How did your, as you became more honest with yourself and with others, how did your friendships change? How did the feel of your life change?
That's a really great question. As I became more honest, the relationships became much more rich, and everybody responded so well to the honesty, and they treasured that and didn't treat it with contempt, but they treated it with respect. And it opened up relationships so that many times they felt free to then confide in me of the pain that they had been through that maybe they were not feeling comfortable sharing either. And again, I think, you know, this vulnerability, if you're vulnerable, it often invites vulnerability from others. So the relationships grew where we could share, you know, areas where we felt inept and incompetent where we were struggling and where we felt humiliated and all of that. It's not just friendships though, as well. It was also my family. So in a dysfunctional environment and family, we didn't talk about anything at all. And so silence was just the absolute norm. And many times, again, we'd have a terrible night of domestic violence growing up, and then the next morning it's like nothing ever happened. And again, we're putting one foot in front of the other, you know, moving on as we need to, but there was no discussion about what happened. And so as I became more free and felt like there were times where it was important to be talking with my sisters, talking with my mom and so forth, and talking about the events that had happened, many times I was the initiator of that. It broke down walls that were there, that we didn't even realize many times that they were there until they were gone. And then all of a sudden you realize, wow, it opened up an opportunity to ask for forgiveness for the things that I had done in my growing up years that, you know, were wrong. And then it invited my mom and others to say, I'm sorry too. And so I've experienced beautiful acts of forgiveness and heart issues where we've wept together about what had happened collectively. And that brought a new dimension of healing. So it's one thing to do it individually, and it's another to actually weep together with my sisters, with my mom, and, you know, more recently with my daughter. I never told her the full story of what had happened with her father. I didn't know how. And I was feeling with my own pain in all of that. And the reality was that it was a church we were going to when we moved to Southern Indiana. And my mom asked the pastor to counsel me because I was falling into a depression. And she had no idea of anything. She only intended the best, but it turns out he was a sexual predator and took advantage of me. And that's how I became a parent. And so how do you tell your child about that without, you know, damaging her own self-esteem? And of course, I was at a place of trying to heal all those years. And she would ask, you know, early on, where is my daddy? And I couldn't answer. I didn't know what to tell her. And so when we, and my daughter and I are very close, I just treasure that relationship that we have. And so I was so afraid that in telling her that I was going to ruin the relationship. And, you know, not, it was so, such a precious resource and precious treasure to me that I just put it off. I didn't want to have to deal with it. And then finally, it's just like, I can't do this anymore. I have experienced tremendous freedom. And I know I'm at the point where I can do this. I can tell her. Because she has her own journey of healing to go through. And when I did that, yeah, there was, you know, there was a shock. There was the anger on her part of, you know, how did this happen? I think there was some resentment as well of, why didn't you tell me this? And I deserve to know. And we had to work through all of that. But I can say that our relationship is stronger, because anytime you're holding back, you know, it's damaging the relationship in ways you don't know. So being truthful has enriched our relationship. And now we can truly talk about anything. And to be honest, it's birthed this experience where, you know, she was so helpful with the book. I mean, and she was my main encourager of writing my story. And of course, I didn't expect that. I thought she would be just the opposite of just, I'm not comfortable with this, so don't go further. I expected her to say that, because I really didn't want to write the book in the first place. I was reticent about it. And her, in the midst of her own processing emotionally, was the one to say, no, you haven't, you've got to tell this story, and you've got to tell it with the completeness which it deserves, which was the shock of my life to hear that.
Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
I think I'd like to play It Is Well with My Soul. It Is Well, yeah, by Christine.
Yes, It Is Well with My Soul. That is the refrain. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Through it all, my eyes are.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Susan Simpkins. So Susan, I stop and I think and I pause. I mean, these are very powerful stories. There's so many places to go. I guess when you began to talk with your family or when you began to talk with your friends, I mean, I suspect you're talking about like 20 or 25 years of processing here.
Absolutely.
And it's not like somebody suddenly takes on a full-time avocation or second job or whatever, but it comes in ways. How did you find yourself introducing what you needed to say, your honesty, your truth, to people who hadn't yet experienced that. You didn't necessarily, I'm sure you were not confident, and you probably desperate in the need to do it, but not confident. How did you find those times, and how did you allow space for them not to become overbearing either to yourself or to others?
Ah, that's a great question. I reconnected with some of my friends from my undergraduate days. So we went to Purdue together and we had such a great community. But after I'd gotten pregnant with my daughter, I basically cut off all my communication with them because I just was ashamed, you know, right. And this situation, how do you explain it? And I didn't want to, I was in denial myself at the time. And so, you know, I couldn't really go there. We reconnected, you know, years later, like what, 2 decades later. It just happened gradually, you know, where we reconnect, we kind of find out what's going on with each other's current life. But then there was like a natural opening for things to happen for me to share that, where all of a sudden it was just, we had the time, we had the space. And it felt right, you know, where it wasn't overburdening, where it's just like, let me tell you, you know, what happened. Let me fill in those years for you in a way that I hadn't before. And so I had prayed, you know, for openings, you know, that weren't off, you know, and just it was sort of forced or anything like that, but more natural and where I was ready and they were ready because I wanted to be truthful. And the thing about, you know, when you start being true to yourself, then you realize more where your faults, you know, this relationship, well, because they didn't know that, and you know, here's what happened. And invariably people, they all were so amazed by what had happened and that they didn't know, and they wish they had, and they wish they had so that they could befriend me in my time of need. They wish they had. Many of them feel tremendous regret, and I'm the one to have to say, it's not you, it's me. I'm not ready. And so I'm still dealing with that because here I published this book, and so it tells my story, and some people are reading it. They're reading it for the first time. They've never heard this. They know me, but they know me on a certain level, and this goes, you know, deep. So I'm still dealing with that, where people say, I wish I could have done more. I didn't know. And I'm just like, no, it's okay. You know? So I had to be ready first to tell.
Yeah. Right. And I'm going to just, many times when I am not ready, it's also my internal homing mechanism sensing that others are not ready too. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So right. In all kindness to yourself, you can't be ready for what those around you are unable or unwilling to know how to begin to deal with. And that's also part of the truth. Yeah.
Right.
You were unfinished chapters in each other's lives.
Right. Yeah. But the irony of it is that as people are opening this book for the first time, there is definitely a way in which I have closed the book. I've written it, I've processed, and it's not that I, you know, get tired of telling my story or don't want to go back there. It doesn't define me anymore. And there are ways in which I've moved on. And so that's a kind of an interesting thing where people are reading for the first time. And, you know, again, the shock sometimes because they know, and I am in a place where sometimes it feels like it's somebody else's story almost.
It's what?
Sometimes it feels like it's somebody else's story that I'm telling. The amount of healing is amazing. And I'm not to say this is perfect. I'm not to say that I'm not in still a healing process, because we all are.
Right. But I think when you don't cringe at things that happen, they no longer control you.
Exactly.
And you have a life that is independent, or at least not defined by those other things. They're part of you, but they don't define you. They don't control you.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really powerful.
Place I didn't, I hoped I would get to, but I didn't know I would.
I think this leads into your second poem. And I want, how did you come to write this second poem, which is, I think, about making that step, that full commitment to living your own life, and it is good.
Yeah, I've suffered a lot with depression in all of this, and, you know, dealing with the pain, the grief, the sorrow. So I've been a magnet for whatever negative emotion there is in my story, and I kind of come from a personality that's sort of melancholic. I wanted to believe that I could get to the place where I had joy, and I think joy to me is the kind of litmus test in a lot of ways of coming through a lot of pain, that if you can experience that. And joy is not just all your circumstances are good, but it's something that comes from the inside, that bubbles up, that says that in spite of all these circumstances, I can be at a place where I still am content, and I am at peace, and also that I am in a place of jubilance and triumph in spite of the circumstances. So this poem.
Can I just sit with this for a second as we prepare to listen to it? One of the sayings is that our capacity for joy is proportional to our capacity for suffering. And the greater suffering we can honestly own and carry, the greater joy we can actually experience and hold on to. They do not cancel each other out, but they widen the spectrum of our lives. And one of the things that I know for myself, my father died when I was 7, almost 8. It was a family that was fraught with my mother's mental illness and all sorts of other stuff. I'm the 7th of 8 kids. Every one of us remembers a different version of the mental illness because we're 20 years apart from beginning to end, and different things were happening. So we've never been able to kind of, as a family, really sit down, although my sisters have. They're only 6, 7 years apart, 8 years apart between the four of them. So it's been a different thing. And what I'm wanting to say here is that when you're comfortable with that kind of suffering, even though you may hate it, draw other people to you, because they see that you can go there, whether you want to or not. Am I making sense here?
Wow, that's so powerful. Yeah.
And in some traditions, they call it the law of attraction. We draw those people.
Yeah.
And we have to find a way to not do that.
Right.
So that's, anyway, thank you. And please do share this.
Yeah. It's called The Day Came. As despair darkened and melancholy mutated, the day came when she disavowed despondency and laughed. As passivity paralyzed and self-pity suffocated, the day came when she defied disability and stood. As naysaying nullified and indecision immobilized, the day came when she renounced restraint and danced. As foreboding festered and self-sabotage strangled, the day came when she held captivity captive and danced, stood, and laughed.
Yes. I'm going to ask you for permission to read this back to you, so you can hear it in my voice as a gift to you who wrote it. And also, I want to note that there are internal references to Handel's Messiah throughout this.
Hmm.
Yes.
I love that.
The Day Came by Susan Simpkins. As despair darkened and melancholy mutated, the day came when she disavowed despondency and laughed. As passivity paralyzed and self-pity suffocated, the day came when she defied disability and stood. As naysaying nullified and indecision immobilized, the day came when she renounced restraint and danced. As foreboding festered and self-sabotage strangled, the day came when she held captivity captive and laughed, stood, and danced.
What a gift, thank you.
And captivity captive is a line from Handel's Messiah, and the paradox of those things clashing, yes, and it is in that Emmanuel, God with us,
yes, yeah,
that you stand.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yeah, and I've been surprised by joy because I never had experienced it before. And it's not just the absence of depression, it's the presence of joy. It's the presence of a person of Christ. And sometimes I'm surprised by it still. And just this morning, my husband prayed for me in preparation for this broadcast. And then there was a song that started to play on his radio. And I just invited him to get up and dance. And we just did. And I'm just thinking, and he was like, what's this all about? You know, it's a normal Wednesday morning and, you know, nothing out of the ordinary and no particularly good news, but it just bubbled up.
Yep. It is beautiful. Beautiful. What should we play next musically?
How about Happy? Farrell.
Yes. Okay.
I love this song because it just reminds me that happiness, joy, it's a choice. And I remind myself of that when I hear this.
Bring me down.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Susan Simpkins. This whole conversation, this whole interview has been a meditation on healing and the fruit of engaging a past and depression with honesty and a fearless living to the future, not to be too much rhetoric in it. But what I want to do now in the final segment is to go to, what do you do to take care of yourself? And, you know, survival is not self-care. That's the thing that we often,
right,
those of us who have survived various things, survival is not self-care. So when did you learn that your self-care is one of the most important things that you can do? That's one question. And then what do you do to take care of yourself daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, and emotionally, physically, and intellectually? So when did you learn how to do it? When and how do you do it?
I feel like I've come to this awareness very late in the game. So, you know, again, my background, growing up in an abusive environment and as a single parent, where self-care is just the last, it's just a luxury I didn't feel like I could afford. And then in all of that, just trying to survive, I didn't really learn a lot about myself, what I really needed. I was just too busy just trying to, you know, just put food on the table and get through the day and all of that. So I think it was things like sabbaticals that I had the luxury of as an academic that really helped to just calm, you know, out of the normal hustle and bustle, that I started to learn more about what I like, even because that's something, again, when you're so busy taking care of other people and not ever being a child really and all of that, it just is a learning process to even give myself permission to do it felt wrong. It just, like, you always just give to others and you just pour yourself out and you run yourself ragged, and that somehow is some sort of virtue. In many cases it is, even in the church, which is sad.
Yes, mistaken for virtue. Yes, yes.
Exactly. So I'm still feeling like I'm, you know, in this process of learning this about what I need. I think the pandemic has helped in this as well. I think that's one of my learning points of this is now, you know, because you can't complain that you don't have the time, you know, anymore, the space. It's like, what do I need? I think getting outside every day to walk or run is really critical, especially in the morning, to have that time to look at nature and trees and breathe in fresh air. It's my prayer time. It's my meditation time. It's my listening time. And then just being in the beauty of the current, you know, the current arrangement of trees. Every season has its beauty. That beauty speaks so powerfully, and it helps me to think about the bigger picture than just the, you know, the minutia of what I have to do in that particular day. So that's been really important for me and critical. And I notice the difference. If I'm not doing it, I know that it's lacking. And when I do it, I'm just much more solid and grounded, and have my perspective is much stronger. Another thing that's really important for me is to be still and to make time for that, to just turn everything off in terms of the phone and get away and in complete silence externally. But the goal is to still myself internally, which is the harder part, and to not be, you know, worried about something or this issue. A prayer that I try to pray often is, I give everyone and everything to you, God. To really try to be free of what are those things that are really occupying my mind, weighing me down, and people in my life that I'm very concerned about, wanting to give to, and concerned about their well-being. But to put that aside, because I've got to be in a place where I can be unencumbered internally. And that's really the space where you hear God the best. Be still and know that I'm God is a verse that I come to often. And that place of stillness is even things that I don't even know happen. It's such a powerful place to then resume, you know, your life on better footing and more solid grounding internally, because I just stopped everything. So that's really important for me. On the physical side, certainly eating correctly, balanced meals, staying away from sugar is really important for me. Sugar is a depressant, and I have a history of depression, so it doesn't go well, even though I really like it. And I think stretching increasingly, I'm finding I have to make the time for that. It's not a luxury, it's a necessity as I grow older. And so I've been doing that more in the mornings. I think weekly, having a day of rest is really important for me. And I think it's important for everybody actually, but again, I have not done this most of my life, just, you know, burning the candle on both ends, but I need it. I need a day off. I need a day where I have the luxury of unscheduled time, you know, where it's not, everything is not by the clock. I've got to do this, feeling like I have, you know, have to perform or have to do something. It's just to take the pressure off and just having, you know, I can sit in the sunlight on the steps in the morning and, you know, just be, and not even be reading anything, not just be sitting or to just get on the porch swing and swing, you know, or just pick up a magazine or read something online, just because, not because I feel like I have to read it or it's required, but just because I want to. And then just have the luxury of a walk that's leisurely. Like, I'm not trying to do it for exercise, like sometimes in the mornings, but just to be, to let myself have that luxury of time that I feel like I can spend that time. Naps are great. I need them in the day, and certainly a Sunday afternoon nap. I love that. So those are things that really help me.
And this quality of curiosity and wonder and play, which comes with a day of rest, and play is not something you get a lot of when you're in a child in a really dysfunctional family, or you get it, but with one ear or one eye constantly looking for what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I was robbed. I was robbed of that, and I really didn't do a good job with my daughter either in play. And she would ask me to play games, and I feel like they were unnecessary and wastes of time, basically, which is sad. Now, the interesting thing is my husband comes from a game playing family where they play games. They play. Mm-hmm. Board games. And so I have all my friends know me that I say, no, I don't play games. Thank you very much. And now here it is, loves to play games. And so, and it's good. It's good for me.
Right. And the ability to be on a mission where you cannot distract yourself with games is not a bad ability to have. It's just not a whole life. And life is not just the games we play.
That's true.
So we bring all these things in balance and in their proper time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you have a message to get out. And part of your self-care is, to some extent, offloading this message.
Ah, that's an interesting twist that I hadn't thought of before.
But it's also... It's also when you offload a message like this and you don't try to engage others too much in their interpretation of it, they own it and apply it in whatever way they will. It becomes their own message. And it's like Isaiah 61, which is, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good tidings to the afflicted. Yes, yeah, to proclaim the release of the captives.
Yes.
Whatever has made us captive.
Right. And Jesus said very clearly in his mission statement that harkens back to Isaiah 61, that he came to heal the brokenhearted. That's his mission.
Yeah. Susan, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
It's been wonderful to have this interview. Thank you so much for inviting me.
What should we close the show with?
Well, we just come out of the Christmas season, and one of my favorites is O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And this is a powerful instrumental rendition by the Piano Guys. I love instrumental piano and cello. And so I think it's a nice way to end the interview.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thank you.